welcome back to HE Podcast, a series where we explore and understand how research works in the environment and ecology and how its implementation can pull us out of climate doom. The HE Podcast is your one-stop shop of curated content on conservation, sustainability, and the environment. This is your host, Namrata Murli. Ecosystems around the world are the result of the coevolution of organisms over millions of years. Organisms in these ecosystems are adapted to their environment and to each other and are interconnected through complex linkages. The exchange of energy and matter, pollination, dispersal, predation, competition, cooperation. All of this goes into the making of healthy ecosystems, which are dynamic but resilient, able to persist and bounce back from disturbance. The arrival of alien invasive species into such ecosystems can be a disruptive force. Invasive alien species can change ecosystem composition, affect the interactions between species, affect people who are dependent on services from natural ecosystems, and also affect ecosystem resilience. Let's explore the answers to how and why this happens with our expert guests today. Dr. Ankila Hiremath is a plant ecologist and a senior adjunct fellow at ATRI. She works in complex social ecological systems in Karnataka's Western Ghats and the Banni grasslands of Kutch and is interested in questions of invasive species, fire management and restoration. Dr. Anita Verghese is director at Keystone Foundation. She leads the biodiversity team, which undertakes implementation and action research projects on human-wildlife interactions, apiculture, restoration, and climate change. Welcome, Anita and Ankila. We're thrilled to have you in our podcast today.
Thanks. Thanks, Namrata, for having us on.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. And thank you for this opportunity.
Ankila, could you tell us what are alien species and does the introduction of alien species occur naturally or does it always involve human activity? And are all alien species a problem?
Alien species are species that are not natural or native to a particular region, right? So these are species that have come in from elsewhere. They don't have a shared evolutionary history with other species in these new ecosystems, but the arrival of alien species is not always related to human agency. Over historical and geological time, species have moved around naturally. So if you think of the colonization of isolated oceanic islands, species have arrived there over millennia through chance dispersals, whether on ocean currents or wafted by the wind. If you think of land bridges that have cyclically been created, linking continents during ice ages, those have allowed for species, large-scale species migrations, and you see similarities in, say, plants occurring in China and Eastern North America, for instance, presumably thought to have arrived over the Bering land bridge. But these are processes that occur over geological timescales. In more recent times, in the last 200 or 300 years, species are being moved around increasingly by people. I guess you can think of post-industrial European colonialism as probably being the first the beginnings of globalization, and over time that has only increased, and people moving species around as they have moved around the world is probably happening at a rate that is unprecedented today. So I think when we think of alien species arrival today, it is largely human caused. Most of it deliberate, and people have always moved species around that are useful, whether as crop plants or for for timber or fuel wood or pets or you know, domesticated livestock. But also for things like hunting, you know, the moving or fishing. So bringing, you know, fish into waterways in one country because they make for good sports fishing, for instance, or even moving songbirds to islands because they were familiar with the sound of those birds in places that they came from. So there are all kinds of reasons why people have moved species around. Are alien species always problematic? No, I would say not necessarily. There are a number of alien species that are very useful to us. A lot of the fruits and vegetables and crops that we depend on, for instance, in India, we think of Darjeeling tea or Nilgiri's tea as something that we take great pride in. But that tea originally came from China. Coffee came from Ethiopia. A lot of our vegetables, tomatoes, potatoes came from South America. So there are a lot of useful alien species, but some proportion of alien species can become problematic when they become invasive. And it's estimated that about 10% of introduced species end up becoming invasive species. But, you know, the going from being an introduced species to becoming an invasive species is a process that takes time and involves crossing several different barriers, if you like. So the introduction of a species from one part of the world to another is sort of one barrier that species cross, and often with human assistance, usually, you know, intentional human assistance, sometimes accidental also. Some species arrive by accident. But then once a species arrives in a country, again, sometimes, you know, they exist as cultivated species or as ornamental plants or crop plants or plantation species. It's only some species that are able to then escape from cultivation and establish populations outside of, you know, human managed systems. And even amongst those, it's only some species that can go on to become widespread, because they might be able to disperse with the help of animal dispersers. So, you know, for instance, take something like lantana, which is one of the most widespread invasive plants in India. It was brought in as an ornamental and garden plant 200 years ago, but by the end of the 19th century, it was already starting to be reported as a species that was becoming locally abundant, and today it's probably one of the most widespread species across the country. You find it everywhere from South India all the way to the foothills of the Himalayas, and it's very successful, partly also because it's a prolific fruiter, and there are a number of native species that feed on its fruits, a number of frugivorous birds, but even things like sloth bear. So it's had that assistance in being able to spread. Not all species form those linkages with native species that might encourage their spread.
So in your studies, Dr. Verghese, what have you found is the impact of the presence of invasives on biodiversity?
Area of work that I'm relatively new to, but getting more and more excited about. And in relation to, what have I seen in my work in the Nilgiris? You know, the Nilgiris, I think, is largely about invasives. I mean, it's a landscape that has been invaded for about, and it has a 200-year-old history, I would say. Recently, I had occasion to see a very old map of the Nilgiris district, and I was quite, I was very disturbed because all I saw was it was a landscape that was without trees. It was a landscape of grasslands. And today, if you look at it, the district is 70% forest cover, and we're very, proud about it and happy about it. But what is that forest is the big question. Yeah, it's not what what was the native vegetation, which was a lot of grasslands, marshes, peat bogs. So the invasion that we've seen here over the years has been largely of trees brought in during the colonial period, the acacias, the pines. And what we've seen is how rapidly they've taken over and altered a whole ecosystem. So today, if our grasslands are endangered, if they have been pushed really to the brink, it's essentially because of invasion. So that, I think, is the biggest impact of invasion that I've seen. The loss of native species, the loss of native habitats, and related to that would be a loss of several ecosystem functions or services that native ecosystem would have provided. So these are the kind of impacts that we've seen on biodiversity over the years. And frankly, even in my own work, which had to do with assessing the population of NTFPs or non-timber forest products, which a lot of indigenous people are dependent on that for their livelihood. It forms a significant proportion of their livelihood. And every time if you look at how these populations of trees or plants are doing, it's not just because of overharvest or because of disease, but it's also because the habitat has changed. It's become such a much more invaded habitat that is having a lot of impact on regeneration, on younger trees having a chance to survive. So these are the kind of impacts that we've seen and I've seen largely in the past 20 years in this landscape. I also wanted to mention that this invasion continues because there's the acacias and pines which came in about 200 years ago. But then there's the Senna spectabilis which came in just 20 years ago, right? Ankila, I don't know if it's 20 to 30 years. And so it just doesn't seem to stop. And today, our dry forests are invaded with Senna spectabilis, a very recent invasive. Yeah, so this is really what I've been seeing here in this landscape.
Could I just add to what Anita said? I think I completely agree. The impacts on biodiversity and ecosystem processes and functioning that she's talked about. I think another thing that because a lot of work on invasive species has been done by biologists. Another thing that we tend to miss often is the fact that these species can also have impacts on human well-being. And Anita alluded to that in terms of impacts on NTFP, which is clear. But when you talk to local communities. They also talk about how the change wrought by invasive species to the natural ecosystems alters the quality of those ecosystems. So if in an open grassland, if you have dense woodland coming in, people who have lived in those with those open grasslands perceive these suddenly dense woodlands as dangerous ecosystems because they can't. It increases their chance encounters with dangerous wildlife, whether elephants or tigers. So these become more sense threatening or dangerous ecosystems for them. So it also interferes with cultural ties to these landscapes built up over generations. So that's another aspect of invasive species that often we don't hear about. Yeah.
How does the presence of invasive species affect the ability of healthy ecosystems to bounce back from the disturbance? And what would the future look like if invasives continued taking over our ecosystems?
The thing with invasive species is that, you know, since they don't have a shared evolutionary history with these environments that they invade, often they can come in and take over and become dominant because they're able to outcompete native species, the kinds of pests and pathogens that would normally keep them in check in their native environments are not present in these new environments, so there's nothing to keep them under control. They can come in and change systems in ways that are often unpredictable. Some invasive species can change the nature of disturbance. So you have this, it's something that's been talked about a lot with the introduction of pasture grasses from Africa, for instance, into places like Hawaii, which never had these grasses. And these grasses evolved with grazing and fire. So when they were brought into these places that they were new to, fire followed these grasses. And fire encourages the growth of these grasses, but other ecosystems may not be adapted to fire. So grassland can gradually replace forest, by encouraging a disturbance that benefits itself. So that's one way in which invasive species can interfere with how natural systems respond to disturbance by changing the disturbance itself. Another is that, most invasive species are successful because they're prolific fruiters and seeders. So often after disturbance, they're the first thing that is able to come back because they're present in such large quantities, their seeds in the soil, for instance. So we've seen this in landscapes where we work in say the BR Hills or Satyamangalam, where well-meaning efforts to remove invasive species can result in other invasive species coming in because they're present in such large quantities in the landscape. some invasive species can change soil conditions. Again, that might benefit the invasive species, but not be as beneficial for the native species that were there originally. So various ways.
But, if I could also add something to this. So, I feel one of the ways has also been the way animals interact then with these plants. We've also seen that in all these invaded ecosystems, how the sambar, for instance, are really gorging on the acacia seeds because it has that sweetened layer around it. The bears are using lantana fruit, pollinators moving to lantana flowers because it's so abundant and profuse and it's available all through the year. So there's also the nature of those interactions which change the plant-animal interactions when invasives invade. But this is also something that we've been looking at. The dispersers change, rodents change, several impacts of the plant-animal interactions.
And Namita, you asked, what would things look like if invasive species continue to take over ecosystems? And that's really hard to say because I don't think anywhere have there been studies that have looked at these processes over long enough terms to be able to say that this is what the future will look like. It's possible that invasive species might peak and then die out, and native systems might recover. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that over time, as Anita mentioned, these invasive species form new biological alliances with native species, seed dispersers, pollinators, but maybe even herbivores that adapt to eat them, so that maybe they become integrated into natural ecosystems, or maybe they transform natural ecosystems irretrievably. We don't know, nor do we know the timescales at which any of these processes might occur. But what we do know is that at least at timescales that we can relate to, over say decades. We're seeing impacts of these invasive species on native biodiversity, and that's a concern because, you know, in a sense, we are responsible for having brought these species in. As conservation biologists, I think we have a certain role to play in trying to prevent the consequences that invasive species are having.
So I guess the best defense that we have against the spread of invasives is prevention of introduction itself. So what are the best practices that we have or we can follow to ensure the prevention and the spread across biogeographical borders?
Yeah, so I can start to take that. So, you know, I think prevention, yes, and what comes with that prevention is an awareness, a willingness. You know, there has to be an awareness in society about introduction, about being careful about introduction. There has to be policies that support or, you know, sort of disincentivize bringing in species. There has to be work at several levels when we say prevention, you know. It has to be at various stakeholders level. So, of course, the human agency we can arrest that way. And I think the other, important way is, what if it was not brought by a human agency, but is there naturally or through some other process? How are we starting to look at the way we manage natural areas, ecosystems, and habitats? If you've started to see a new invasion, if you've started to see a new colonization, it's high time that we act fast enough. And I think this has to do with also not just the plants, you know, the snails and several other species that are getting in. It's not just plants that are invasive, right? So how fast do we respond? I think our response time is a bit slack and lagging. And we only seem to be addressing the problem when it has covered hectares and hectares. Yeah, and I think that's something. And this whole business of being aware of what introducing species, you know, the consequences of introductions has got to be it has to be taught at many levels. But it has to be taught to forest managers, it has to be taught to students of forestry, to students of biology. It has to become a part of an important part of our curriculums at every stage. And I think that's what I would say is one of the ways forward. And I'd like to, you know, share the case of, for instance, in Keystone, we work a lot with bees. And we've been right from the start about native bees. Whereas we have a whole, a push for honey production. And that doesn't have to do with production from native bees. It has to do with production from introduced bees. And we're not even thinking of the consequences that if these introduced bees enter the forest, destroy the habitats of native bees, or outcompete for food resources with native bees. You know, we're not even talking or thinking that far. And it's not a very distant future. You can talk, you know, you can just imagine, you can model what will happen if you introduce these species. And I think we're not willing to even talk about that. So introductions continue and a lack of awareness. I'd say we don't care enough about it, and we're not aware of the seriousness of the problem. Yeah, Ankila, would you have some?
No, I completely agree. I think there's a lack of awareness at multiple levels, including at the, you know, at the level, the highest levels of policy making. So, you know, if you look at other countries, there are specific legislations pertaining to invasive species, regulating their introduction, for instance. In India, we don't yet have anything of that nature. We rely on existing legislation, regarding the introduction of crops or other genetic resources, fish and other animal genetic resources, but these were legislations enacted before invasive species were a problem that people were aware of. So, for instance, let's give you the example of the plant quarantine order, which has a quarantine weed list. But if you look at that weed list, none of our known invasive species feature on that list, right? So where the focus is on weeds of agriculture and crop plants rather than on invasive species in a larger sense. So I think starting from there and all the way down to the common layperson's understanding of invasive species, there's a lot of work to be done to build that sort of I think awareness and ecological literacy, about invasive species, about the potential dangers of introducing species. Other countries have things like pre-introduction risk assessment systems. We have that again, but very specifically for, say, diseases of crop plants, for instance, not invasive species in general. But that's in terms of, preventing the arrival. But I think Anita also alluded to the fact that, there are already invasive species that are here. And there, too, we don't really seem to be aware of the potential dangers of continuing to promote them. So, several of our known invasive plant species, for instance, are still available as ornamental plants. Several of our non-invasive species are being grown as avenue trees in cities or being promoted for afforestation in places. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of building awareness and starting to think about this and how we tackle this problem.
So where does our response begin? What can we start doing to manage these invasive species spread that are already in the country, like you said?
That's a great question, but one that I think there's no simple answer, because again, as we touched on earlier, the process of a species becoming invasive takes time. So you think of it as this sort of I guess people talk about the invasion curve, where species hang around and spread slowly, and then get to a point where suddenly they start to spread exponentially. And as Anita mentioned, our awareness of invasive species seems to be of those species that have already spread exponentially, they're everywhere. But by the time we start noticing species that have become so abundant and widespread and started having the kinds of impacts that we start worrying about, it's all already almost too late in a sense, because any efforts at trying to eradicate species at that stage would be prohibitively costly. So by the time species get to that stage, I think the options are really to try and control them locally. So in landscapes where conservation is a priority, maybe local control of species is really the kind of management we can practice. But before species get to that stage, eradication is feasible. It's just not something we think about, because we're not out there observing and monitoring these species. So I think what is really important is to have in place some sort of monitoring of invasive species, so that we can detect when a species starts to become problematic or invasive, and tackle it at that stage where it's still feasible to tackle, rather than wait for it to become really widespread, by which time it's too late. Yeah.
And Ankita, it might also, when we talk about monitoring and creating this kind of a baseline, I mean, there are countries that have done it, right? We have lots of examples to fall back on and learn from. And it's not an impossible task. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree. And I think South Africa is probably one of the best examples where over time, with you know, created this atlas of invasive species across the entire country. So, you know, it's become a valuable resource for managers to know, you know, which are the priority species, you know, which are the ones that are becoming most widespread, which are the habitats where these species are getting into that should be priorities for management. So, yeah, it is possible and doable, and certainly very worth doing. Yeah.
So we can all agree that invasives are bad for the ecosystem, but both of you did mention the livelihood enhancement from NTFPs and how it affects all of this. So what would you say is then, how could we just eradicate it without posing a threat to livelihoods?
So I think what both of us were saying is how invasives have impacted livelihoods because they've threatened the native plants that communities were dependent on, so many of the wild foods that they are used to collecting seasonally from the forest are no longer being found or becoming harder to find. So many of the, you know, the traditional way dependence on forest has been negatively impacted because of suddenly the forest is full of one kind of species and it's choking and throttling every other life form. So that's definitely one of the ways that livelihoods has been impacted. There's also been several efforts to create new livelihood options out of invasives, right? So that's getting to be quite popular, and forest departments are getting into MOUs with local agencies to train communities and using several of the invasives to make crafts and different kinds of things in ways to harvest it. So, I mean, we are hoping that, and I hope that we're still thinking that we're hoping to create those livelihoods to eradicate the species, not to build a livelihoods based on the species. You know, there's this huge difference, because then you also need to know that whether your harvesting of that particular species is leading to its eventual decline or control. I don't know if we're doing that. You know, we're talking about the livelihoods, but we're not putting in the monitoring to see that if I'm cutting these stems, is it making that plant much more resilient, much more, dominant, and put, you know, is it putting out more shoots because it's being harvested? So, you know, I think we need to put those kind of monitoring mechanisms in place, and don't lose track of our, you know, what was our goal? We set out on this road to build a livelihoods with invasives, essentially to remove the invasives, to clean up the ecosystem, right? And sometimes I worry a bit that we've lost track of that goal. Yeah. So these are some of the ways that I think about livelihoods and invasives. Ankila, your thoughts on this too?
No, I would agree. I guess there are two types of situations. One that you've mentioned where people are trying to encourage livelihoods based on invasive species, and I, like you, hope that we don't lose sight of the goal that this is being encouraged as a way of using up those species, if you like. But I think that, you know, those efforts can take on a life of their own, and I'm not sure what the outcome might be. But then there are also other situations where I think invasive species have come in, and, you know, local communities have sort of been left with no choice other than to try and create livelihoods based on the invasive species, because their former livelihoods have been taken over or replaced by the invasive species. And I think Prosopis juliflora mesquite is a good example. You know, it's taken over agricultural landscapes in parts of Tamil Nadu. It's taken over pastoralists, grasslands in parts of northwestern India, and people have resorted to making charcoal based on Prosopis. So I think there, the solution becomes a little more complicated, because you know, do you go in and say, okay, we're removing Prosopis because it's an invader? I think the approach probably has to be a little more gradual, because people have, you know, adapted over time to depend on these invasive species. So maybe the approach one takes in these, you know, human-dominated landscapes has to be very different from the approach we take in conservation landscapes, for instance. I think it's hard to come up with blanket prescriptions, I feel, yeah.
Recently, Keystone Foundation and Atri conducted a marathon at the Nilgiris. Could you tell us what and how and why this was important, and how was this done using citizen science? And could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I'm happy to start talking about this. So this was something that has been, I think, something that Ankita drove very hard, that this whole aspect of citizen mapping of invasives, you know, I think... I want to say that this is something that we've been discussing for a long time, because what's going to make it so exciting for citizens to go out there and map? Yeah, because one thing is, if it's a migratory species, then you see it once in a while. If it's a very charismatic species, and there's a certain kind of, how do you sell invasive plants which are like all over and so dominant in your backyard? How do you sell this to people? You know, like, yes, it's dominant, but we want you to know the differences. There are more than 23 species that are in your backyard, which could be potential threats. So, you know, the whole build up to the mapathon was something that we really had to work on, and it took a lot of communications, it took a lot of programs. And I think over a couple of years now, we've been doing regular programs with colleges, with forestry departments, with citizen groups, with whoever would give us an audience to talk about why invasives, why these 23, how did we come down? So all of that led to us then being ready for a mapathon. And, you know, of course, all the tools that we developed for mapping, and to then get people interested. And it was really interesting, because I think people, of course, it was people who liked plants or who thought a little bit more about plants who came out. So we had botany departments, we had, you know, people who were already into plants. And then from there, we also thought, how do we get into people who are into birds, into other species? So people who are out regularly observing nature. Photographers are another category of people. So when people are already in the practice of going out and looking at nature, how do you also then instill this one more lens of looking at the invasives in that landscape? And then, you know, this is how we've been building up the interest. And we had quite a bit of participation. We had people from all walks of life. And we keep these walks pretty short, because it takes a lot of time to just stand every 100 meters, look at the various species. In the Nilgiris, easily at one point you'll have at least more than 3 species that you have to document. So this is how we've started working on this. And we also think that this is not just a one-time event. You know, how do we make this a part of our regular work? Like, maybe there could be 6 days on World Forestry Day, on Environment Day, whatever you're doing. If you're doing a bit of tree planting, or you're doing some monitoring of water, how do you spend 1 hour or half hour of that time also monitoring the invasives in that area? So this is what we've been doing. I think easily we may have talked to and disseminated this to more than 2,000 people over the course of our time. I'm sure of that, and Forest Department, different citizens, students. We try to address the diversity that we have in the district. Yeah? These are some of the things that I would like to share, and then Ankita.
I absolutely agree. I think, invasive species are so widespread that I think the only realistic way of mapping where they are and monitoring them is if we can do this with the involvement of large groups of people. And so this, you know, something like these citizen science mapathons are really, I think, a way to go, because if researchers are out there trying to map invasive species at a scale that is meaningful for management and conservation, I think it would take far too long. So I think, but as Anita mentioned, people are more accustomed to watching birds or tracking migratory species or flowering events rather than invasive species, which are all around anyway, part of the background noise, if you like. So I think it's been a process of building awareness, trying to get people interested, trying to sort of get them to understand what we're doing, and I think it's an ongoing process, and needs to become part of other things that are happening. Can't be a one-off.
So, how effective is this process and this way of mapping, and what other ways of mapping could be used to do this more effectively?
Yeah. So I think, as Anita just mentioned, it's and we were alluding to the South African experience a little while ago, where it's been a very, very effective effort, and over several decades they've mapped invasive species across the entire country of South Africa, which is a huge achievement. So I think it's doable. But I think as an approach, it's very powerful. But I think it requires that building of interest and communicating with various groups of interested citizens, students, forest department staff, because I think it would take that kind of collective effort to achieve. You asked about other ways of mapping. Again, the only probably other ways of mapping at a scale that is meaningful would be using remotely sensed information. But other than, say, trees in grasslands where, maybe you can detect them easily because they're so different, a lot of invasive species come into forest understories, for instance, so they're not as easily detectable through remote sensing, and you would need to use very high resolution imagery in order to be able to map them, and that's very expensive. So again, to do that at a large scale is not really feasible. So I think this way of mapping is probably the best way of trying to do it, but I think it requires building that kind of interest and awareness and larger involvement.
So what's the way ahead now that the mapping is done? What would the way ahead look like?
Do you want to take that a moment to begin with?
Okay, I can take I can think, we're just thinking about this, Namrata, because I think whenever Ankila and I meet, this is what we're always talking about. What's the way ahead? What are the big ideas? What are the plans for the future? So, there's several roads that we need to take. And I think, again, the whole awareness part of it and building a sort of, a sort of wanting to do something about it, a sort of feeling of that at different levels, from policymakers, to students, to people who have gardens, to people who raise nurseries. Everyone must be sort of plugged into this, giving natives a chance, pushing back invasives, whatever sloganeering we can do to make this possible.
Continuing with with the kinds of efforts we've been making and trying to take them forward, I think I'd like to end on a positive note, that it's sort of fortuitous that, you know, we started this pilot work in Tamil Nadu, because Tamil Nadu is probably the only state in the country that has, you know, formally recognized the problem of invasive species to the extent of having come up with a policy on invasive species removal and restoration. So, you know, we found, for instance, the Tamil Nadu Forest Department to be extremely responsive to the work that we've done with them. We've had, you know, we mentioned earlier how we've been talking to many, many groups of people, and that includes Forest Department staff, and we've gone out and mapped with them in various different protected areas, and had a very positive response. So hopefully, you know, having landed on fertile ground like this, we'll see progress from the Forest Department and in mapping invasive species in protected areas, and maybe that will set an example for other parts of the country for us to build on. So, yeah, looking forward to, you know, working with different groups of people to take this forward to other places as well.
So, in the spirit of ending things positively, we've reached the end of this episode on understanding invasives and maintaining healthy ecosystems. So thank you once again, Dr. Hiramath and Dr. Varghese, for taking the time to converse with me today.
Thank you for this.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Okay, bye.
Stay tuned to our channel for more insights into the environment and the problems we face globally. Do subscribe to our channel to stay connected.